My name is Frank Edwards. I am the author and narrator of this unique radio series, Strangest of All. The series is actually based on my four books, which deal entirely with unexplained and unexplainable phenomena. The books, like my newspaper columns, are based on documented events which defy explanation in the light of conventional knowledge. Fascinating true stories about the famous and the near famous and their baffling experiences. Dreams that have produced great inventions and dreams which have solved crimes. Disappearing ships and planes and people. Some of these cases very recent. Every field of human endeavor, including the very newest, that of outer space, has contributed and is contributing to this fascinating collection of documented reports. Strangest of All packs a wallop unlike that of any other program, because no other program has such a wealth of material. Around the world, in print and on the air, each day, millions of people enjoy my fantastic but factual report. Your audience will enjoy them too. Here, for example, is a modern mystery. From the Canadian Mounted Police comes the story of a village that literally vanished. 35 men, women, and children who disappeared so suddenly that their guns and food were still in place in their huts, awaiting the owners who never came back. And the story of the incredible manner in which a queen was saved from death by a moth. The true story of the weird signals from outer space, which the U.S. Navy recorded on film, so shocking that the film had to be filed and forgotten. And the story of a nationally famous physician who was summoned to the bedside of a woman he did not know by a girl who did not exist. The first ship that ever made the passage across the Arctic Sea, with a captain and crew who had been dead for 13 years. In 1963, the Australian government found three beautiful metallic spheres in the desert of New South Wales, and the Minister of Supply admitted to the Australian House of Representatives that these spheres did not originate on this earth. You will hear, in Strangest of All, the astounding results of a request for professional astronomers to watch the moon, why they did it, and what they saw. Of fires that consume human beings, but which are harmless to the surroundings. Of the strange objects which are making a systematic surveillance of every important man-made center, what they are, and how they operate. The reports in this series run the gamut of science and history and every phase of human activities. They are indeed strangest of all. This is Frank Edwards saying welcome to our program.
This is a position in the program where you have your first connection as a sponsor with your public. However, let me take this opportunity to tell you a little about this fabulous man, Frank Edwards, a man who was a pilot at the age of 15, an accredited newsman doing on-the-spot coverage of the Floyd Collins tragedy, one of the original members of Pioneer Radio Station KDKA in Pittsburgh, served a time as a golf pro, produced many travelogues of the South Seas and Antarctica, holding the post of special consultant to the military in World War II, and a noted author, obviously is not content with an 8-to-5 routine the rest of his life. Frank has searched the world over for stories of the unusual, one of which he relates now.
One of the most devastating and unpredictable pranks of nature is the earthquake, which spreads death and destruction without warning. Science has devoted much time and thought to ways of knowing in advance when earthquakes can be expected, but little, if any, progress has been made. But for Bob Barr of Oakland, California, earthquakes are an open book. On April 25, 1954, shortly after 1:30 on that Sunday afternoon, Bob reached over and turned off the radio program to which he had been listening. Then he rubbed his abdomen and said, "There's going to be an earthquake. I've got that funny stomach ache again." Seconds later, a trembler hit the city of San Jose with a shuddering jar. Bob Barr guessed that it would register about 5 on the Richter scale, which measures the violence of quakes. As a matter of fact, that particular trembler registered exactly 5 on the scale. Barr feels that he has a stomach that is seismographically sensitive, to such an extent that he can detect earthquakes at great distances when they are of considerable magnitude. The more violent the quake, the more pain he feels in his stomach. And this sort of built-in earthquake predictor has been functioning for him for 20 years, says Mr. Barr. Scientists don't believe it. They say he cannot predict earthquakes, and that when he does it, it is pure coincidence. Mr. Barr only smiles. He has predicted many an earthquake, which is a record that the scientists who criticize him cannot approach. There is admittedly some factor which some living creatures sense and which enables them to know in advance of an impending earthquake. In the case of the Alaskan quake of March 1964, the animals and birds in zoos all along the west coast of the United States became wildly excited a few minutes before the trembler ripped the city of Anchorage apart. We have no way of knowing whether these creatures in the zoo share Bob Barr's mysterious tummy aches, and no way of knowing that they do not. Somehow they knew, and they were terrified. Perhaps a clue to the mystery is to be found in a discovery which was announced by George Moore of the U.S. Geological Survey Laboratory at Menlo Park, California, who says that just 66 minutes before the Alaskan quake of March 27, 1964, there was a measurably sharp change in the Earth's magnetic field. He suggested this might be due to the stresses in the rocks, which also caused the quake. At any rate, a measurably sharp change in the Earth's magnetic field might explain why the birds and animals in the zoos got so excited, and might even explain Bob Barr's prophetic stomachache.
Thank you, Frank. And now, let me tell you a little of our success with the Strangest of All series. We originally started with a much smaller number of episodes of Strangest of All, but the demand for more of these rare and unusual episodes have led us to increase the number of available programs to 520, with more being contemplated. An amazing 90% of stations now carrying this program have continued uninterrupted into the second and third year of broadcast. We feel sure with the inclusion of this program in any advertising picture, you will be ordering the series for the second and third year, and even into the fourth and fifth year, for more of these stories of the strange and unusual, as reported and recorded for you by Frank Edwards. Now, we've presented the program to you. The rest is up to you. It's not an expensive proposition, as you can see by consulting the rate chart accompanying this presentation. And it's the type program that will hold and gain listeners for you and do a selling job. Now, we'll be glad to aid you in merchandising this program to your best advantage. In addition to on-the-spot merchandising aids, such as window banners and so forth, the Frank Edwards books have been a very successful self-liquidating item in several areas. Our service to you does not end at the signing of the contract. We seriously endeavor to help you in any way possible. Thank you for letting us present Strangest of All.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Unique among American warships was the Watery, for she fought her only battle on dry land. I'll be back in just a moment with the story of the Desert Dreadnought. It was a strange name for a battleship, but then the Watery was a strange battleship. She was a sidewheeler, a wooden ship with huge, awkward paddle wheels in wooden boxes on either side of the vessel. The Watery was proud but passé, outmoded before she slid down the ways in late 1864. Commissioned too late for use in the Civil War, perhaps it was just as well, for she was a wooden ship born into the days of the ironclads. Fitted with some small cannon, given a captain and a crew, the Watery was sent out to sea, banished, you might say, from the sight of a navy that had no need for her. For a couple of years, she bummed around the Caribbean. Then, by easy stages, she ventured down the coast of South America and around the Horn to Aconcagua in Chile. Her orders were to act as a morale builder for the shaky Chilean government by merely hanging around, showing her cannon, and waving the stars and stripes. This sort of thing had been going on for more than a year when the crew began to get restless. The Watery needed some repairs, so the skipper asked for permission to return to the States. The permission was granted, but it came too late. Destiny had already made other arrangements for the ugly duckling of the United States Navy. Captain Alexander was sitting in his cabin one evening, reading the letters which had just been brought to him from a passing mail steamer. The messages were a month old, But even that was pretty good service for the time. The captain's log picks up the report at this point, for he wrote, "While servicing the mail, I noticed that the cabin lamp was swinging fore and aft, a most unusual procedure. I noticed this because we were anchored well inside the bay, and there was no wind. I hurried on deck and quickly recognized the disturbance as a submarine earthquake, since the water was visibly draining out of the bay. By prompt action, we managed to swing the watery around, but in a matter of minutes we were aground with our stern to the sea. I anticipated," he writes, "that we might be able to right it by cutting the anchor cable, and this was quickly done. The stench from the exposed harbor bottom was most distressing, and several members of the crew became ill. Others, including the officers, managed to endure the stench by breathing only through handkerchiefs which had been soaked in vinegar, a practice which is to be recommended under such conditions. The great wave which came surging in from the open sea struck us and broke high above the stern of the ship and did heavy damage, as well as sweeping overboard three crew members who were never seen again. We had no control of the ship and indeed felt ourselves fortunate to be afloat." Riding the wildly churning waters of the great tidal wave, the Watery was driven inland with scores of other craft. Thanks to her shallow draft and flat-bottom construction, she rode it like a raft, coming to rest finally at the foot of a great cliff, 2 miles from the sea. Scattered about her was the wreckage of other vessels and the debris from the wrecked city itself. The barren sand that stretched for miles along the face of the cliff was strewn with tempting bait for looters. And like locusts, they came to prey on the plunder. Captain Alexander armed his crew with pistols and warned the swarms of looters away. But when morning came, he realized that he was in for serious trouble, for his vessel was tilted at such an angle that it could easily be boarded by the mob that was milling about. Already his tired crewmen were forced to discourage the more determined thieves by knocking them off the rails with clubs, a form of defense that could not long prevail in the face of such odds. The Watery offered such an irresistible piece of plunder that the mob had already marked it for its own when daylight came. They were milling about just out of pistol range. The Watery's hour was at hand. Captain Alexander had two of the cannon pulled from their moorings and propped up so they would face the mob. Unable to find the metal shot for the guns in the wreckage below decks, the captain bethought himself of an ingenious substitute: hard, round cheeses from the galley. When the screaming mob came surging across the sand toward the gunboat, Alexander held his fire until they were only a couple of hundred yards away, and then the cannon roared, and balls of cheese skipped over the sand. A couple of men were bowled over like tenpins. Another broadside sent the mob fleeing in wild disorder. They had had more than enough cheese. The Watery was broken up for salvage where she lay, listed in the Navy's records as lost in action. She enjoys the unique distinction of being the only battleship that fought a battle on dry land, firing cheese balls at a gang of thieves.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened.
Assassination of President Lincoln. But was a high official of the government also involved? I'll have the evidence for you in 1 minute. An outraged nation clamored for vengeance on those who had plotted and carried out the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. John Wilkes Booth, the vain, bombastic trigger man, was subsequently shot to death. Mary Surratt, at whose house the crime was plotted, died on the gallows with 3 other characters, all convicted of involvement in the same dastardly crime. That much is clear from the record. But were they the real plotters, the brains behind the crime itself, or did their deaths merely enable others to avoid exposure? The plot called for the simultaneous assassination of President Lincoln, Vice President Johnson, and Secretary of State Seward. And had this happened, Secretary of War Stanton would then have become a power to be reckoned with. He was cunning, at times brilliant. He was also ruthless, hard, and power-hungry. But the plot was bungled. Johnson and Seward survived. And after a few brief hours as acting president, Stanton was again reduced to his capacity as Secretary of War.
On the night of Mr. Lincoln's murder, Stanton hurried to the house where the stricken president lay dying and set up an office in an adjoining room. Directing the activities of the government from that point, he was promptly informed that John Wilkes Booth was the killer. But for 5 hours, Stanton refused to issue a public statement naming the killer. And when at last he did so, he furnished newspapers not with a picture of Booth, but with a picture of Booth's brother. And Booth himself used those 5 hours of grace to make his escape. Only an unforeseen accident prevented the getaway being successful. Lafayette Baker was the head of the Secret Service, and he was in New York City at the time of the assassination. Because of the news blackout which had been imposed by Mr. Stanton, Baker knew nothing of the murder until noon of the following day. He hurried back to Washington to find the killer's trail grown cold, the search itself a welter of confusion. The Army, under Stanton's direction, was refusing to cooperate with other official groups. Secretary of State Seward had issued orders that Booth was to be captured and brought back alive so he could be questioned. But Secretary Stanton refused to pass those orders along to the troops who were searching for the assassin. Now, this Lafayette Baker was a bit of a scoundrel himself. He worked under Mr. Stanton, but the men admittedly distrusted each other. Theirs was a marriage of convenience based on Stanton's cunning and Baker's lack of scruples. On April 24th, Lieutenant Luther Baker was called to the office of his cousin, the Secret Service chief. After a brief conference there, they went together to the office of Secretary Stanton, who told Lieutenant Baker where he would find John Wilkes Booth. Later, on the witness stand, Lieutenant Baker testified that Stanton did not tell him to make any effort to bring Booth back alive, although by then all the other search parties were under such orders. Booth died of a gunshot wound which Sergeant Boston Corbett, a crackpot fanatic, claimed to have inflicted. But the evidence indicates that Booth died of a pistol shot in the back of the neck, inflicted at such close range that Booth's neck was powder burned. Corbett, who was armed with a rifle, was 30 feet away when the shot was fired. The only man inside the barn with Booth was Lieutenant Luther Baker, who was acting under orders from Stanton himself. The pistol shot that killed Booth in Garrett's barn sealed the lips of the one man who might have named all his co-plotters had he been brought in alive. The subsequent military trial, which brought about the execution of Mary Surratt and her 3 co-defendants, silenced others who might have talked. Lafayette Baker testified that he turned over Booth's complete diary to Secretary Stanton. Stanton first testified that he had never seen the diary, but later came back and said that he did have the diary after all, but that pages representing more than 2 weeks immediately prior to the killing of Lincoln were missing. The military court ruled at Stanton's request that no deletions had been made from the diary. For months before the assassination, an employee of Stanton's own department, one Lewis Whiteman, talked openly of the plot being brewed at the Surratt home where he boarded. He was never questioned before the killing, which might have prevented Mr. Lincoln's untimely death. But for his services as a witness at the trial that silenced Mrs. Surratt forever, Whiteman loafed for years on the public payroll as long as Stanton held office. Lincoln asked to be guarded on that fateful night by Major Eckert, who was one of Stanton's employees. But Stanton refused. So, instead of Major Eckert, Lincoln's life was entrusted to a dissolute scoundrel named John Parker, who promptly deserted his post to visit a nearby tavern. And as soon as Booth saw him there, he knew that the way to Lincoln was open. Yet Parker was never prosecuted, and he too remained on the public payroll as long as Stanton was in office. The official investigation of the circumstances which led up to Mr. Lincoln's assassination left many important questions unanswered. But the unexplained actions of Secretary Edwin M. Stanton are strangest of all.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
For half a century, science has been recording strange radio beams from elsewhere in the universe. Are they signals from outer space? I'll have the full report for you in just a moment. Radio signals from outer space are not new, but they are just as mystifying today as they were when Marconi first picked them up more than 50 years ago. The father of wireless was conducting some experiments on his yacht in the Mediterranean when he detected signals which he regarded as code, meaningless to him. He instructed one of his co-workers to make a public statement on the matter at a scientific and business banquet in New York. Marconi's remarkable telegram was read, it created some headlines, and then was quietly dropped. Nikola Tesla, the famed Yugoslav electrical wizard, also reported receiving cryptic code signals, which were most numerous and strong when the aerial was turned toward the planet Mars. Like Marconi, Tesla had no qualms about making a public report on his findings. If Mars was trying to reach us, these scientists felt that we should know about it. In 1924, engineers for RCA admitted that they too had picked up these mysterious chatterings, which did not fit the patterns of any known code, but which bore the earmarks of being intelligently conceived. The signals were recorded by RCA, discussed, then filed and forgotten. But they were suddenly recalled by a remarkable experience which befell the scientists in the Naval Research Laboratories in Washington. Scarcely more than a year after the RCA incident, the naval research experts were testing the Jenkins process for recording wireless signals on photographic film. Out of the ether came a weird chirping that made no sense in terms of intelligible code. But when the film was developed, the scientists were astounded at the results. Instead of recording as intermittent dots and dashes, the weird code had arrived in such a fashion that it was recorded in the form of faces. Crude caricatures, to be sure, but faces beyond a doubt. In 1926, the United States government financed a project which was designed to contact Mars by radio if possible. Scientists from Johns Hopkins University, aided by radio experts from both the Navy and the Signal Corps, selected a spot in Nebraska. There, they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars constructing a powerful transmitter and delicate receiving sets. For 2 weeks, they sent radio signals in the direction of Mars and waited hopefully for some indication that they had been heard. The net result, according to the official statement, was inconclusive. 30 years later, great observatories all over the world were installing costly radio telescopes, huge metallic dishes that can be focused on individual planets. On June 4, 1956, the Naval Observatory in Washington announced that it had succeeded in making what it called the first radio contact with Venus, a contact which led them to believe that Venus had a surface temperature about equal to that of boiling water. Ohio State University reported that its radio astronomer, Dr. John Krause, had used their radio telescope to receive two types of signals, including the Class II signals, which, said the university, have many of the characteristics of a terrestrial radio transmitting station. These signals, which Dr. Krause said resembled radio telegraphy in many ways, were received only when the giant radio telescope at the university was trained precisely on Venus. One of the strangest, and perhaps one of the most significant of these bizarre broadcast incidents, occurred in England in 1953, when many television viewers were startled to see on their screens the station identification card and call letters of television station KLEE in Houston, Texas. The signals came in strongly throughout a large portion of the British Isles during two consecutive days, and many viewers recorded the freak broadcast by photographing the picture on their television sets. Notified of the unusual reception, the British broadcast engineers had no difficulty picking up the same signal. Now, freak long-range television pickups are rather more common than most viewers realize, and the British authorities attached no unusual significance to the reception of KLEE until they contacted the Texas station. Then they got a real shock. KLEE went off the air in 1950. The successor to KLEE notified the British that no KLEE identification card had been televised at any time since 1950, 3 years before the picture was picked up in Britain. The officials in Britain ruled out the possibility that it could have been a pointless practical joke, which would have cost at least $100,000 to perpetrate. Where did the signal come from? Why was it beamed only to the British Isles? The chief engineer for the British Broadcasting Company said, "Our investigation leaves us with but one possibility, however incredible, that these signals were transmitted to us purposefully and intelligently from a source and for a purpose presently unknown.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Abraham Lincoln called it the song that saved the Union. The lady who wrote it called it the song that wrote itself. I'll be back with its remarkable story in 1 minute. The Battle Hymn of the Republic is one of the most stirring songs ever written. Abraham Lincoln cried the first time he heard it, during the darkest days of the Civil War. The music to Battle Hymn came from an old Southern camp meeting song. Say, brother, will you meet us on Canaan's happy shore? But where the words came from was quite another story, and a very strange one. On the night of November 18, 1861, the fog from the nearby Potomac River was drifting through the streets of the nation's capital. Long lines of dispirited Union soldiers shuffled past Willard's Hotel. Some of them stumbled along, for they'd been marching all day, marching with heavy hearts from the defeats of yesterday to the uncertainties of tomorrow. In a corner room of Willard's famed hotel, the pretty red-haired wife of a Boston social leader sat beside her window in the darkened room, watching the long lines of troops trudging past in the gloom. Ordinarily, Julia Ward Howe would have been asleep at this hour, but this was no ordinary occasion. Fate had chosen her for a strange mission. The campfires from the Anacostia Flats blinked at her through the mists over the Potomac. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100-person camp. They have gilded him. Mrs. Howe watched the living panorama for a long time before she decided to retire. She was exhausted from her long train ride from Boston, and she slept soundly. Shortly before daylight, she found herself sitting at the writing desk in the corner of the room. She wrote rapidly, which was unusual for her. Heretofore, she had always found rhyming difficult, but on this cold gray dawn, her pen flew across the paper, scratching out the lines that were to make her name live in history. It was so dark in the room that she could scarcely see the paper, but she didn't bother to light the candle on the desk. She wrote as one inspired. If she had a mission in life, she was now fulfilling it magnificently. Long after daylight, when she awakened, she found that she had written a poem of 5 verses on a sheet of stationery from the government agency where her husband worked. She recalled vaguely sitting at the desk in the darkness, but she remembered nothing of what she had written. But there it was, so well written that she felt compelled to change only 4 words in the entire work. It was entitled, The Battle Hymn of the Republic. But she could recall neither the verses nor the title. What to do with this piece of work? She mailed it to the Atlantic Monthly Magazine, where it was published as a poem in the February issue of 1862. They sent her a check for $4. Great songs like Great Men and Great Ideas must arrive on the scene at exactly the right time and place. And so it was with the masterpiece of Julia Ward Howe. Her forceful and moving little poem fell into the hands of Chaplain Charles McCabe of the 112th Ohio Volunteers. He had it in his pocket when he was captured at Winchester and sent to Libby Prison. McCabe noticed that Mrs. Howe's poem fitted perfectly to the tune of John Brown's Body, which had been borrowed from the old Southern song, On Canaan's Happy Shore. McCabe sang Battle Hymn to his fellow prisoners, and they soon sang it with him. One night, when a Confederate guard told the prisoners that the rebels had just won another smashing victory in Pennsylvania, the prisoners were sunk in gloom. But a few minutes later, another trusty, who served in the officers' mess at the prison, brought them the real story, that the Union had won a great victory at a little town called Gettysburg. McCabe and his fellow prisoners sang the Battle Hymn of the Republic till the windows rattled. His truth goes marching on. Months later, McCabe was released as an exchange prisoner and sent back to Washington. There, in a crowded theater, he told the audience of his experiences in Libby Prison and of the song that shook the walls. He sang it for them, and suddenly they were singing it with him. President Lincoln rose to his feet, tears streaming down his cheeks, and asked them to sing it again and again. Julia Ward Howe said of her masterpiece, "I wonder if I really wrote it." I feel that I did not. I was just an instrument. It really wrote itself. When she died in 1910 at the age of 91, a chorus of 100 little children from the Perkins Institute for the Blind told her goodbye as they sang,
Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
I think you'll agree with me that it's a wacky world. A world where one man got shot by a cigarette. Another was run over by a bathtub. And a steam shovel went headhunting. In just a moment, I'll be back with a full report on the oddballs of 1958. Science spends a great deal of time and money in its laudable efforts to understand and explain how and why strange things happen. But the day-to-day events of our modern world sometimes defy explanation. And sometimes the scientists themselves are involved. For instance, a veteran research specialist for General Electric got a call from his wife asking him to pick up a basket of eggs at the home of a friend who lived near his laboratory in Syracuse. He remembered the eggs, and as he approached a railroad crossing, he remembered that it was very rough. So he reached back with one hand and steadied the basket of eggs as he drove slowly and very carefully across the track, or almost across. There just happened to be a freight train coming along at that moment. It struck the good doctor's car and knocked it in front of another engine, which was going in the opposite direction. Fortunately, neither engine was moving very fast. The scientist was badly frightened, got a bump on his head, and his car was a wreck. But the eggs were perfect. How do you think science would explain that one? 1958 produced bumper crops of wheat and corn. It had also produced a bumper crop of unpredictable incidents, such as the case of the hitchhiking jackrabbit of Grand Island, Nebraska. Mr. and Mrs. Joe Ambers of Columbus, Ohio, were driving across country, and as they rolled along the highway west of Grand Island, they were suddenly reminded that they were in jackrabbit country, for their windshield dissolved in a shower of fragments as a rabbit came through it head first. He plunged into the back seat of the car. Joe and his wife agreed that it was some jackrabbit, but it turned out that the critter was a bit of a sissy. His first automobile ride killed him. One of the least appealing aspects of being a telephone lineman is that of having to work down in manholes, hour after hour, while the world rumbles past overhead. Sam Bradford of Ithaca, New York, was repairing some telephone cables in a manhole when a caller dropped in on him, a 9-year-old girl who landed on the back of his neck. Only a surprise visit, nobody hurt. 2 weeks later, Sam came out of a manhole, just in time to meet the street sprinkler, face to face. But Sam isn't complaining. One of his buddies was also down in a manhole when a truck loaded with sand turned over and poured its cargo down in the hole with him. The lineman got out all right, told reporters he wasn't frightened at all, a real man of grit. Ed Taylor of Matawan, West Virginia, was probably congratulating himself on having found the parking space into which he was carefully backing his new car. Just at that moment, a power shovel knocked down a utility pole. The pole fell across Ed's car. Naturally, Ed was curious about all the rumpus, so he stuck his head out the car window, just in time for the clam shovel to slide off the top of the car and close its jaws around Ed's head and shoulder. 30 minutes later, when they got him out of his predicament, unhurt, Ed hurriedly drove away and let someone else have his parking place. And the cigarette that shot a man? Well, that's a matter of record in Beloit, Wisconsin, where Jim Drager will gladly tell you how it happened. He was merely relaxing in his big easy chair one evening, and he casually placed a lighted cigarette in the ashtray. Earlier that evening, his 5-year-old son had placed a .22 caliber shell in the same tray. The cigarette heated the cartridge, there was a bang, and Jim was nicked in the arm, shot by a cigarette. No other cigarette can make that claim. Ben Quinlan of St. Louis got into the wreckage in 1958 through an ironic twist of fate. Ben, you see, is a safety director for a large industry in St. Louis, and he tries to practice the safety that he preaches. But fate played a mean little trick on him. After a nice, safe day at work, Ben went to bed for a well-deserved snooze. During the night, a bed spring worked loose, popped through the mattress cover, and stabbed Ben right in the middle of his night's rest. Runaway bathtubs are rare indeed, so rare that they are mentioned only once in the records of this busy year. Scientists calculate that your chances of being struck by a runaway bathtub are billions to one in your favor. But look out for that one chance, as Andy Anderson of Oakland, California will tell you. Andy was parked on a mountain highway, fixing a tire, when a truck loaded with bathtubs came roaring down out of control. Two bathtubs came spinning toward Andy. He leaped over the first, got hit by the second, saw the top of his new car bashed in by still another tub. You are often admonished to avoid accidents by using horse fence, but even that seems to have taken a turn for the worse. Just outside Ann Arbor, Michigan, two delivery wagons approached each other. The horses became frightened and knocked each other silly when they crashed head-on. But, of course, they have a perfect alibi. The horses were using man sense.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Electronic instruments tell us there are tons of gold there on Oak Island, and it may be yours for the taking. But getting it may be a bit difficult. I'll be back in 1 minute with the incredible true story of the treasure in the well. Then Oak Island may be the end of the rainbow for you. Like the proverbial pot of gold at the rainbow's end, you may find it a bit elusive, but it's there, no mistake about that. The lucky ones have touched some of it. The better-equipped seekers have watched the indicator needles on their gear flutter to match their own hearts. But one and all, they've had to admit defeat, for the treasure of Oak Island has been so cunningly concealed that it defied the best efforts of all comers for almost a century and a half. Oak Island is a tiny rocky knoll that sticks up from the cool blue waters of Mahone Bay in southern Nova Scotia. Nobody paid much attention to this insignificant speck of land until 1795. On a bright Sunday morning in April of that year, three young men rode out to the island and spent the rest of their lives wishing they hadn't. Tony Vaughn, Danny McGinnis, and Jack Smith knew that Oak Island had been used as a haven of refuge and repair by the freebooters who infested the seas in those days. The pirates could anchor in one of the convenient deep coves on the north end of Oak Island, post a lookout in one of the several tall trees, and go about their business of removing the barnacles from the ship's bottoms in comparative safety. Old Teach came there, according to local gossip, and Morgan and Steve Bonney and other notorious scum of the seas. They came there and they traded with the canny Nova Scotians, and they paid handsomely to the local authority to look the other way while the pirates camped out on Oak Island. One by one, the pirates had been hanged or driven from the seas. And when Smith and Vaughn and McGinnis rode over to the island in 1795, they knew that no pirates had been there, openly or otherwise, for at least 7 years. But they knew, too, that the roistering freebooters had left a lot of evidence of their visits. Pistols, knives, sometimes a gold coin or two could be scraped from the sand of the little beach where the pirates gambled and fought and drank. It was Tony Vaughn who called the attention of his two companions to a worn place on the limb of a huge oak tree, and to the strange depression in the soil directly beneath that same tree limb. They agreed that it looked very much like heavy ropes had been looped over the limb to lower something ponderous into a hole that had later been carefully filled in. Working quietly in their spare time for several years, the three boys finally dug down to a depth of about 35 feet. Then, in 1803... Smith told Dr. John Linds of their strange find and of the thick layers of coconut fibers they had discovered at the 35-foot level. It was a fateful day for Dr. Linds when he first stood there beside that pit,
For in the ensuing years, he spent his entire fortune probing its depths for the treasure he was so confident that it contained. Workmen paid by the doctor pulled out at successive 10-foot levels layers of heavy oak planks, a layer of ship's putty, and more thick, tough layers of coconut fibers, presumably hauled there by pirates who had loaded the stuff in the West Indies 2,000 miles away. Beneath a layer of oaken planks at the 80-foot level, the workmen found a flat stone covered with unintelligible hieroglyphics. As a last resort, when his funds were virtually gone, Dr. Linz brought in a large hand-powered drill, and with it he probed to a depth of 100 feet. The drill cut its way through brittle plaster and more hardwood, then it seemed to drop into some sort of subterranean room. The next effort with the drill, racing against the water that was rising rapidly in the pit, brought up a few scraps of gold and a bit of paper, and moments later, disaster, for water broke into the pit with such a rush that three workmen drowned, and Dr. Lind was bankrupt. If he had established nothing else, he had given his fortune and 9 years of his life to prove that there was gold in some sort of a man-made vault about 100 feet below the scarred old oak tree. It was 46 years before Dr. Lind was able to try again. In the gold rush madness of 1849, old and rheumy-eyed, he gathered about him a small group of financial backers. Their workmen reopened the crumbled pit, sank it 10 feet deeper than ever before, until they came to a hard layer of cement. The drill broke through into that room again, brought up a bit of gold chain. And again, just as success seemed inevitable, the water came pouring in and ruined them. Other treasure seekers down through the years, including Franklin D. Roosevelt, have spent lavishly of their time and money on Oak Island. They have confirmed that the gold is there, that it is cunningly protected by seawater brought in through tunnels, and that the gold is likely to stay there, for in 1957, modern engineers found it just as real and just as elusive as ever.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Alarmed citizens of Devonshire patrolled the countryside where something had left tiny footprints even on their rooftops. I'll be back in 1 minute with the fully documented report on the Devil's Footprints. The good citizens of Canvey Island had never seen anything like it, and they were disturbed. So they dragged the creature out of the shallow water onto the beach, covered it with seaweed, and ran for the authorities. The authorities sent for help, too, and the British government assigned the task to a pair of competent zoologists. These gentlemen examined the fantastic creature at length, photographed it, measured it, and finally admitted that it looked like nothing they had ever seen or heard of before. It appeared to be some sort of marine creature, but it had feet and legs so arranged that it could walk upright if it chose. In an upright stance, it would have been about 2.5 feet tall, with a thick, tough, brownish-red skin, a pulpy head with two protruding eyes. Well, the scientists measured and photographed and gave up. They had the thing cremated and left without making any public conclusions. If these learned gentlemen thought they were ending the enigma of Canvey Island once and for all by that simple procedure, they reckoned without the facts, for the case certainly did not end there. On August 11th, 1954, the Reverend Joseph Overs was walking along the beach of Canvey Island, just a couple of miles from the scene of that earlier monster, when he too came upon a grotesque carcass wallowing in a small tidal pool. The good man took one look at the thing and sent one of his youngsters for the police. The bobbies pulled the carcass ashore and sent for the experts again. The creature which had been found in the preceding November had been about 2.5 feet tall. This one was slightly more than 4 feet in length, weighed about 25 pounds, and was in good condition for examination. The report which the perplexed scientists submitted to the British government shows that the thing had two large eyes, nostril holes, a gaping mouth with strong, sharp teeth, and it also had gills. But instead of scales, it was covered with a pink skin, which the experts reported was as tough as the hide of a healthy pig. Perhaps the most remarkable part of all, this creature, like that of the preceding November, had two short legs with perfect feet, feet which ended in 5 tiny toes, arranged in a U-shape with a concave center arch. If science was able to identify these monstrosities, The report was never disclosed. But to many, the things brought back memories of that incredible night in February of 1855, when the English countryside around Devonshire had a most remarkable visitor or visitors, which may or may not have been akin to the strange creatures found 100 years later on the shores of Canvey Island. The story was written in the form of little footprints in the smooth blanket of snow that covered the countryside during the night of February 7th, a gentle snowfall that ended around 11 o'clock that night. Somewhere between the end of the snowfall and the break of day on February 8th, Devonshire had played host to a mysterious visitor, something that had scampered or pranced or slithered over fences and fields, over walls and housetops, leaving an unbroken line of thousands of footprints to mark its passing. What was it, this thing that could travel nimbly up the walls and over the rooftops of decent, God-fearing folk while they slept? Where did it come from, and where did it go? Well, where it came from remains a mystery. But where it went was written in the snow, from Topsham and Bicton in the north to Dawless and Totnes in the south, a trail more than 100 miles long. A baker in Topsham, a chap named George Fairley, seems to have been the first to take notice of the trail. He saw the strange marks that preceded him almost to the door of his little shop. But from a point about 3 feet short of his door, the tracks turned sharply right to a 5-foot-high brick wall. Mr. Fairley noticed that the soft curl of the snow atop the wall had been disturbed by the same little U-shaped footprints. He was not disturbed by this oddity. That remained for the other residents of the community. By nightfall, the countryside was up in arms, for there were many who attributed the tracks to the devil himself. Tiny, hoof-shaped marks exactly 8 inches apart, from Exmouth across fields and housetops to the bay near Powderham Castle, only to reappear on the other side of the bay and then on to the end of the trail at Totnes, many miles to the south. The London Times and other newspapers devoted many columns to reporting the strange story of the Devonshire footprints. There were various explanations ascribing the marks to kangaroos, birds, even a wolf. None of these was acceptable because none of them fitted the facts. Perplexed experts nervously advanced the theory that 2 or 3 creatures of unknown type had been involved, a theory that was convenient but unconvincing, unless you were willing to agree that 3 unknown creatures were all possessed of the same irresistible urge at the same time at 3 different spots on the coast of Devonshire on the same night, and that after romping over the housetops, they fled back into the sea, never to be seen again, unless, by some strange chance, the 2 monstrosities washed up on the coast of Canvey Island in 1953 and 54 were a clue. Did these creatures point to a solution to the riddle of the Devonshire footprints of a century before, or did they merely add new questions to compound the mystery for science?
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Police were admittedly desperate after weeks of investigation had failed to solve the disappearance of Joy Aiken. Did she tell them where to find her killer? I'll have the fully documented story for you in 1 minute. Science is admittedly operating under difficulties when it endeavors to explore the human mind. The very nature of the study precludes success in many respects. Science has learned a great deal about the mind in the past few decades, thanks to new instruments and new techniques. But, reduced to its fundamentals, it becomes a program of the mind studying the mind, and that complicates the problem. We know that the human mind is capable of some very remarkable feats, which we can only record without understanding. That it may also be capable of other and even more incredible attainments is a matter for debate. For example, let us examine the case of Joy Aiken, found in the police records of Pinetown, Natal, South Africa, under the date of October 9, 1956, and attested by 4 senior police officers and 46 invited witnesses. Joy Aiken was a few days past 17 years of age when she vanished in the middle of September 1956. Joy was a very pretty girl. She was also very shy. Joy had no steady boyfriend, nor did she have any enemies. Why, then, had she disappeared? Her family suspected foul play, and the police concurred. They sent out bulletins bearing her picture to police posts throughout South Africa. A reward was offered for anyone who could provide information leading to the finding of the missing girl or her body. Weeks passed without results. There were a few crank tips,
the usual crackpot reports which are to be expected, and, as customary, they came to naught. Joy Aiken had vanished as completely as if the earth had swallowed her, which police suspected it had done. The missing girl's brother, Colin Aiken, visited the police station in Pinetown each day in the hope that they might have learned something that would lead them to the end of their search, whatever that might be. Each day the police had to tell him that they had found nothing, and by October 8th, they admitted complete defeat. On that same day, Colin heard, through a friend, of the retired headmaster of the school, Mr. Nelson Palmer, who had located some missing items for various of his close personal friends. Mr. Palmer did this, said Colin's friend, by merely relaxing, closing his eyes, and subsequently describing what his mind seemed to see. He was embarrassed by the knowledge that he could do this, and he never discussed it for fear of ridicule. Colin Aiken and the Pinetown office of the South Africa Police were of the same opinion. They had nothing to lose by asking Mr. Palmer to try. A senior police officer visited Palmer and his wife that night and finally secured their consent to a meeting on the following day, October 9, 1956. While 50 persons sat silently in the two front rooms and the hall of Mr. Palmer's home, he leaned back in his chair and closed his eyes. His breathing became heavy and labored. Sweat covered his face and began to trickle down from his chin. For many minutes, there was only the sound of his breathing, and those who were present, some of them, began to suspect that that was going to be the extent of the program. Then, Palmer's lips began to move, but the sound that came from them was a voice like that of a young girl, and it was a young girl in terror. "I am dead," said the voice. And then there was a silence for 2 minutes, according to the police record. After that, Palmer's lips began moving again, and he said, "My body is in the ravine near the high rocks. A man has attacked me. He's killing me." Palmer's eyes opened, and he seemed to be staring without seeing. A few minutes later, he began breathing normally and arose from the chair. Says the record, and again I quote from it, "Mr. Palmer then told us that the girl's body was partially concealed under some stones near a culvert at a spot about 60 miles from Pinetown. The murderer," he said, "was a man named Clarence, about 30 years old, who had hidden the murder weapon, whatever it was, in an outbuilding at his home. Mr. Palmer said he believed he could lead us to the place where the body was hidden." 1 hour and 40 minutes later, Palmer led police to a lonely spot on the highway along the coast of Natal. There, under a culvert and partially hidden by stones, they found the body of the missing girl. Joy Aiken had been beaten and then shot to death. What of the killer? Palmer had described him as a man named Clarence. Relatives recalled that Joy had known a chap by that name, Clarence Gordon Van Buren. 10 hours later, police placed Van Buren under arrest. In a shed behind his home, they found a gun, which he later identified as the murder weapon. It was the old, old story of a frustrated lover. He had lured her into his car, he said, lost his temper, struck her, then shot her to death in a fit of anger. How did Palmer know where to find the body? Joy's family prefers to think that the dead girl told him, somehow. But Palmer scoffs at the idea. "Nothing supernatural about it," he says, and he adds, "I have found missing pieces of jewelry by the same process, whatever it is, and these pieces of jewelry certainly didn't tell me where they were. I think the human mind," he said, "has some perfectly normal capabilities which we do not understand, and this projection in time is merely one of them."
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards. And now here is Frank Edwards.
Armed guards stood watch beside the tomb both day and night, but the coffins continued their strange antics. I'll be back in 1 minute with the amazing true story of the restless dead. Scientists who investigated carefully had to admit defeat, for they could arrive at no logical explanation for the strange events that were uncovered on the sweltering afternoon of August 24, 1943, when a group of Masonic officials opened a sealed grave on the island of Barbados. It was the tomb of Sir Evan MacGregor, who had been buried there in 1841. But the Masons were not interested in Sir Evan. Instead, they wished to pay tribute to one Alexander Irvine, who was the father of Freemasonry in Barbados. Irvine's remains had been placed in the same vault prior to those of MacGregor. The crypt itself had been carved out of the native stone of the island and was so constructed that it projected about 4 feet above ground, resting on a concrete and brick base which extended underground to a depth of about 4.5 feet. Entrance could be obtained only by descending a flight of 6 steps and opening a sealed door. After the heavy cover slab had been removed, it was found that the doorway to the vault itself was sealed by having been bricked up. As the bricks were being removed while the waiting Masonic officials sweltered, the workmen called attention to a metal object of some sort which had become visible through the aperture they had made by removing the bricks. A little more careful work and the nature of the metal object became unmistakable. It was a coffin sheathed in lead, and it was leaning against the only door to the crypt, head downward. Little by little, the bricks were removed and the heavy coffin eased away from the door until it rested once again on the floor of the tomb. The Masonic delegation was understandably mystified. How did this 600-pound lead coffin, containing the remains of Sir Evan MacGregor, get out of its niche on the opposite side of the sealed vault? What could have moved it after the vault had been carefully sealed more than a century before? And what had caused the 3 tiny holes in the lid where the coffin had been sealed with solder? Confused though they were, the Masons had little time to ponder the problems presented by this state of affairs, for they had another puzzle on their hands. There was no trace of either the coffin or the body of Alexander Irvine. His remains had vanished completely from the niche in the vault where they had rested at the time MacGregor's coffin had been placed beside them. Both men had been entombed in heavy lead-covered coffins, placed side by side on cement shelves. Now, one coffin had vanished, and the other had somehow managed to cross the crypt and end up in a standing position against the sealed door. The Masons placed a guard at the tomb and went away to ponder the puzzle. They reported to the authorities of Barbados, who in turn promptly called in several learned men to conduct an investigation. Examination of the church record showed that both men had been entombed in that same crypt, and the crypt had been sealed. All witnesses agreed that the seals had not been broken, and that the crypt had been in perfect condition when the workmen began to open it on that hot afternoon in 1943. Yet, somehow and sometime, very strange things had happened inside the vault. After lengthy deliberation and careful investigation, the scientists came away as baffled as the Masons had been. All of them went away to ponder the unexplained disappearance of Alexander Irvine, whose remains should have been in the sealed tomb where they had been placed. Except, they were not there, and nobody knew why. The disturbances in the vault we have just mentioned are by no means unparalleled. Also on Barbados, but in a different cemetery, miles from the scene of the Irvine mystery, officials were plagued with the eerie antics of the coffins in the vault of the Chase family. Time after time, down through the years, as various members of that family were taken to the crypt for entombment, the other coffins inside the sealed tomb were found in wild disarray. In each case, they found the heavy capstone in position, sealed with a thick layer of molten lead, and no trace of tampering. And, in each case, when they finally removed the seals from the inner door, they found the inside a shambles. Coffins tumbled about. The lead-covered box that contained the body of Sir Thomas Chase was so heavy that it required 8 good men to lift it. But time after time, it was found upside down on the side of the crypt opposite the shelf on which it belonged. Oddly, and perhaps significantly, only 2 coffins remained untouched, those of Mrs. Goddard, the original occupant of the tomb, and that of a baby girl, Mrs. Goddard's granddaughter. Armed guards placed beside the vault day and night were unable to prevent recurrences of the disorders that occurred inside it. Eventually, the Chase family had to remove the bodies and re-entomb them elsewhere. In the old Christ Church Cemetery of Barbados, the Chase vault still stands, its heavy stones and coral intact, and appropriately enough, carved into the thick capstone is a large question mark, a reminder of the restless dead.
Stranger than science. Incredible but true events that have baffled mankind since the day they happened. Narrated by Frank Edwards.
Is it possible for a man to be swallowed by a whale?
and live to tell the story? The logical answer is no. But the correct answer is yes. And I'll be back in a moment with the amazing true story of this modern Jonah. Official records of the British Admiralty provide documentary evidence for the astounding account of James Barclay, a British seaman who was swallowed by a whale and lived to tell about it. James was making his first and only trip as a sailor aboard the whaling ship Star of the East. In February of 1891, she was pounding along before a fair wind a few hundred miles east of the Falkland Islands in the South Atlantic. Suddenly, the lookout gave his electrifying cry of, "There she blows!" For he had sighted a huge sperm whale half a mile off the port bow. The Star of the East slackened her sails, and the whaling crew scrambled into their three small boats to harpoon the mighty mammal, if possible. Young James Barclay was in the first longboat to reach the side of the whale. Pulling slowly on their oars, the sailors drove their frail cockle shell behind the unsuspecting creature, so near, in fact, that the harpooner could lean over and drive his huge spear deep into the whale's vitals. Barclay and his fellow seamen backed frantically to get out of the reach of those massive tail flukes, which threshed the water to foam as the stricken beast fought to free itself of the barbed harpoon. For a moment, luck seemed to be with the sailors. The whale plunged deep into the ocean. 800 feet of heavy line streaked out of the tub before the creature ceased to dive. Then, there was an ominous slackening in the line. The great brute was coming up. But where? In such cases, this was a matter of life and death, and the sailors did not have long to wait. They hunched over their oars, ready to pull for their lives once they knew which way to pull. Without warning, the sea boiled up around them. There was a splintering crash as their frail boat spun into the air. The mortally wounded whale thrashed about madly in its agony, beating the water to a bloody froth before it sounded into the depths again. A nearby longboat picked up the survivors, but two men were missing, and one of them was the apprentice sailor, James Barclay. The wind, which had borne the Star of the East to the scene of this tragedy, now deserted her, and she waddled in the long swells hour after hour, her sails flapping idly. Shortly before sunset on that same fateful day, the dying whale floated to the surface, about 400 yards from the vessel. The crew hastily fastened a line to the whale, and the winch brought it slowly to the side of the ship. Hot weather made it imperative that it be cut up at once. And since they had no means of raising the 100-ton mammal to the deck, the men took flensing spades and peeled off the thick blubber as they slipped and slid along the creature's back. It was dirty work and dangerous, for the water was full of sharks maddened by the taste of blood. Shortly before 11 that night, working by lantern light, the tired crewmen removed the stomach and the huge liver and had them hoisted aboard ship for processing. Once on deck, they were startled to notice movement inside the giant paunch, a slow, rhythmic movement that looked like something breathing. The captain hurriedly called the ship's doctor, and a great incision was made in the tough flesh. A human foot became visible, shoe and all. A moment later, and they had pulled out one of the missing sailors. It was James Barclay, doubled up, unconscious, but alive. Perhaps for want of anything better, the excited ship's doctor ordered Barclay drenched with buckets of seawater. It was a treatment which soon restored consciousness, but not reason. For Barclay was babbling incoherently as he thrashed about in his delirium. For almost 2 weeks, he lingered between life and death, strapped to the bunk in the captain's cabin. Gradually, so the ship's doctor wrote in the record, which was signed by all on board, gradually Barclay recovered his senses. But it was a full month before he was able to tell them what had happened. He remembered being flung into the air when the whale crushed their longboat. And as he fell back into the sea, he saw the tremendous mouth open over him. He screamed as he was engulfed. "There were sharp, stabbing pains," he said, as he was swept across the rows of tiny, sharp teeth. Then he found himself sliding down a slimy tube. He could recall fighting for his breath, kicking about, and then blissful oblivion, until he regained consciousness a month later in the captain's cabin. He had been inside the whale's stomach for 15 hours, and as a result, he lost all the hair on his body. His skin was bleached to an unnatural whiteness that never left it, and he was virtually blind for the rest of his life. which he spent as a shoe cobbler in his native Gloucester, England. Numerous medical men from many lands came to examine him and to discuss his incredible experience. He lived 18 years after his remarkable adventure, and on his tombstone is a brief account of his experience and a footnote which says, James Barclay, 1870-1909, a modern Jonah.